welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, when winter is storming up north, is ever so grateful to call South Florida home. There's an upcoming annual event in my town that puts the focus squarely and deliciously on food, the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. In its honor, I've been inspired to offer up a full serving of sumptuous choices. Books on cooking, famous chefs, fun food thrillers, even some truly eye-opening exposés on the food industry. And to cause a stir, my guest today is a mixology magician. Yep, we're talking cocktails. I know you'll find him fun and refreshing. It's all on the menu as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Wood Mode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. In the 1950s, America was a land of overdone roast beef and canned green beans, a gastronomic wasteland. Authentic French, Italian, and Chinese foods were virtually unknown. Cooking at home wasn't thought of as a source of pleasure, guests didn't chat around the kitchen, and professional equipment and cookware were used only in restaurants. One man changed that. From best-selling author Thomas McNamee comes The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat, Craig Claiborne and the American Food Renaissance, the first biography of the passionate gastronome and troubled genius who became one of the most powerful forces in the history of American food. From his start in 1957 as food editor of the New York Times, Claiborne was going to take his readers where they had never been before. He extolled the pleasures of exotic cuisines, and with his inspiration, restaurants of every ethnicity blossomed. So many things we take for granted today were introduced by Claiborne: creme fraiche, arugula, balsamic vinegar, the Cuisinart, chef's knives, even the salad spinner. He gave Julia Child her first major book review. He brought Paul Bocuse, Jacques Pepin, and Paul Prudhomme to national acclaim. And while he defended French Nouvelle Cuisine, he also reveled in a well-made stew or a darn good hot dog. Claiborne was the perfect Mississippi gentleman, but his inner life was one of conflict and self-doubt. Through McNamee's painstaking research and eloquent storytelling, we learn the story of a great man who, until now, had never been truly known. Dick Hill narrates.
This was Craig Claiborne's dream job. New York was where he was meant to be. His element, he'd felt it from his first moment. The glamour and the gaiety. So many chic women. So many such good-looking men. The dark hum of power unceasing under it all. The voice of the New York Times, the ultimate voice of authority, was now his. And he had more than a dream. He had a plan. He was going to teach America what good food was, and bad. With his intelligent and sympathetic criticism, a new excellence would arise. He had looked forward to an exploration of fine dining in America's leading fine dining city, but New York's supposedly best restaurants were proving quite a disappointment. Craig had been classically trained in cooking and in service at the best hotel school in the world, in Lausanne, Switzerland, and he had learned there just how fine the degrees of excellence were that could be discerned by a well-trained palate and a discriminating sense of taste. He expected to find, in the serious restaurants of New York, a more than ample arena in which to exercise his critical faculties. The city had, after all, attracted a plethora of French and other European chefs brought up in the rigorous traditions of their homelands. The farms of northeastern America were capable of growing fruits and vegetables as good as those of Europe. The region's pastures were rich and abundant. The Atlantic and its bays, sounds, and estuaries teemed with fish and shellfish. Jet planes could now bring to these shores fresh European wild mushrooms, truffles, Normandy butter, sole fresh from the Strait of Dover, even the matchless fishes of the Mediterranean, turbot, Saint-Pierre, loup de mer. Money was no constraint in the post-war boom years, and the topmost restaurants of New York charged accordingly. By the end of his first year and a half at the Times, however, Craig was fed up. His experience of the city's restaurants, with one exception, had ranged from dispiriting down. Though he longed to celebrate the greatness that he knew a serious restaurant could achieve, time and again he found himself stymied. He really believed in his mother's old southern maxim that if you can't say something nice, you shouldn't say anything. If a place displeased him extremely, his preference was not to write about it at all. When pressed by his editors, he would comment only with his native strained reticence. Of Maud Chazelle, his faint praise was that it is to this establishment's special credit that the beans were cooked properly. One can picture him blinking in prim dismay at Trader Vic's Scorpion, a gardenia-bedecked potion served to four persons from one container equipped with four straws. It seemed to pain him even to mention the traders Queen's Park Swizzle and the Dr. Funk of Tahiti. One easily deduces his thrill at covering the opening of a new branch of the Stouffer's chain in Garden City, Long Island, of which he managed to observe that it had a capacity for 586. Or the Continental Restaurant in a shopping center in Paramus, New Jersey, where the closest he could come to saying anything nice was that opulence and a long menu are very much in evidence.
That was The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat by Thomas McNamee. The book report predicts this title, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, will be the biggest expose to hit the food industry since Fast Food Nation. Intelligently written by Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Michael Moss, it's the story of the rise of the processed food industry and its link to emerging obesity. Every year, the average American eats 33 pounds of cheese, triple what we ate in 1970, and 70 pounds of sugar. We ingest double the recommended amount of salt, almost none of which is from the shakers on our table. The villain? Processed food. It's no wonder that 1 in 3 adults and 1 in 5 kids is clinically obese, and that 26 million Americans suffer from diabetes. Moss features examples from the big names, Kraft, Coca-Cola, Kellogg, Nestle, and more. He takes us inside labs where food scientists use cutting-edge technology to calculate the bliss point of sugary beverages or enhance the mouthfeel of fat by manipulating its chemical structure. He talks to execs who confess they just cannot produce healthy alternatives to their products. Simply put, the industry itself would cease to exist without salt, sugar, and fat. Scott Brick narrates.
The first thing to know about sugar is this. Our bodies are hardwired for sweets. Forget what we learned in school from that old diagram called the tongue map, the one that says our five main tastes are detected by five distinct parts of the tongue. That the back has a big zone for blasts of bitter, the sides grab the sour and the salty, and the tip of the tongue has that one single spot for sweet. The tongue map is wrong. As researchers would discover in the 1970s, its creators misinterpreted the work of a German graduate student that was published in 1901. His experiments showed only that we might taste a little more sweetness on the tip of the tongue. In truth, the entire mouth goes crazy for sugar, including the upper reaches known as the palate. There are special receptors for sweetness in every one of the mouth's 10,000 taste buds, and they are all hooked up, one way or another, to the parts of the brain known as the pleasure zones, where we get rewarded for stoking our bodies with energy. But our zeal doesn't stop there. Scientists are now finding taste receptors that light up for sugar all the way down our esophagus to our stomach and pancreas, and they appear to be intricately tied to our appetites. The second thing to know about sugar? Food manufacturers are well aware of the tongue map folly, along with a whole lot more about why we crave sweets. They have on staff cadres of scientists who specialize in the senses, and the companies use their knowledge to put sugar to work for them in countless ways. Sugar not only makes the taste of food and drink irresistible, the industry has learned that it can also be used to pull off a string of manufacturing miracles, from donuts that fry up bigger to bread that won't go stale to cereal that is toasty brown and fluffy. All of this has made sugar a go-to ingredient in processed foods. On average, we consume 71 pounds of caloric sweeteners each year. That's 22 teaspoons of sugar per person per day. The amount is almost equally split three ways, with the sugar derived from sugar cane, sugar beets, and the group of corn sweeteners that includes high fructose corn syrup, with a little honey and syrup thrown into the mix. That we love and crave sugar is hardly news. Whole books have been devoted to its romp through history, in which people overcame geography, strife, and overwhelming technical hurdles to feed their insatiable habit. The highlights start with Christopher Columbus, who brought sugarcane along on his second voyage to the New World, where it was planted in Spanish Santo Domingo, was eventually worked into granulated sugar by enslaved Africans, and starting in 1516, was shipped back to Europe to meet the continent's surging appetite for the stuff. The next notable development came in 1807, when a British naval blockade of France cut off easy access to sugarcane crops, and entrepreneurs, racing to meet demand, figured out how to extract sugar from beets, which could be grown easily in temperate Europe. Cane and beets remained the two main sources of sugar until the 1970s, when rising prices spurred the invention of high fructose corn syrup, which had two attributes that were attractive to the soda industry. One, it was cheap, effectively subsidized by the federal price supports for corn, and two, it was liquid, which meant that it could be pumped directly into food and drink. Over the next 30 years, our consumption of sugar-sweetened soda more than doubled to 40 gallons a year per person, and while this has tapered off since then, hitting 32 gallons in 2011, there has been a commensurate surge in other sweet drinks like teas, sports aids, vitamin waters, and energy drinks. Their yearly consumption has nearly doubled in the past decade to 14 gallons a person.
We've just heard Salt, Sugar, Fat by Michael Moss. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit IBRShop.com. That's IBRShop.com, where small is beautiful. Roker's aha moment came a decade ago. He was closing in on 350 pounds when he promised his dying father he would change. That led to his decision for a stomach bypass and his drop to 190 pounds. But 50 of those pounds crept back until he devised a plan, stuck to it, and got his life back. In Never Going Back, Winning the Weight Loss Battle for Good, Roker writes an inspiring, often hilarious story of self-discovery. With illuminating and painfully honest tales about his childhood, his struggle against the odds to succeed, and his family life, Roker reveals the effects that a lifelong battle with weight issues can have on a person. Most importantly, Roker, who narrates, shares that losing weight is a state of mind.
I was born in Queens, New York, in 1954. I am the oldest of six kids, three boys and three girls. Three of us are the biological children of my parents, and three were adopted through foster care. I am one of the biological kids, along with a sister who's 6 years younger and a baby brother who is 17 years younger than me. Although I was a premature baby weighing in at 4 pounds, 10 ounces, at a certain point very early in my life, I just started eating and never stopped. I suppose my family heritage added to my genetic lot in life. Both of my parents came from families who loved to eat. My mom, Isabel, also known as Izzy, was half Jamaican, and my dad was from the Bahamas. Dad looked like a young Sidney Poitier, who happened to be from Exuma, the same island in the Bahamas where my father's family was from. When my dad was younger, people often did a double take when they saw him driving his white Plymouth Valiant station wagon, the same car Sidney Poitier drove in Lilies of the Field. My parents met at John Adams High School in Queens. My mother was one of the first African-American cheerleaders at the school, at the time, a very big deal. She must have loved being a cheerleader, because I grew up hearing a constant chant of, "Rickety-rackety shanty town, who can knock John Adams down? Nobody, nobody, absolutely nobody. Yeah, team!" Honestly, I can't believe I still remember her saying that, but I do. My dad was an affable guy and a really sharp dresser. He was a very good storyteller who enjoyed sharing tales from his younger days. Turns out my dad was a stone-cold thug. He had friends with names like Deadeye and Jelly Roll. He had a walking stick that had a knife in it. Yeah, growing up, he was a tough guy. But by the time his children came along, he was a short teddy bear. I like to say I come from folks built low to the ground, with one leg shorter than the other, the better to lean into the wind and survive hurricanes. Of my parents, Dad was definitely the gentler one. If you fell and skinned a knee, you went right to Dad. He'd comfort you and give you a big bear hug, whereas Mom was more likely to tell us to stop crying. Her approach was the early version of man up. You might say Izzy was the original Tiger Mom. She was tough as nails, and unlike a lot of women of her generation, she enjoyed confrontation. To her, it was sport. I knew I was loved by her, but she knew exactly how to needle me and what drove me crazy. Whenever she'd come to my house for dinner, just as I was serving the meal, she'd ask, "Is this any good?" "No, I just spent an hour making you something that tastes like crap," I'd respond. Mom loved to banter and was a real joker. She was also honest to a fault and didn't believe in coddling. She taught my younger daughter, Leela, to play checkers as a kid. Most grandparents let the kids win, but not my mom. No way. To her, losing is how you learn. And now I call Leela Little Izzy, because she's so much like my mom. I once overheard her playing Monopoly with some of her friends. She wiped the board. Then one of her friends asked, "Where'd you learn to play Monopoly?" "My Nana," Leela said with great pride. I couldn't help but smile. I was what you might call a late bloomer. As hard as this might be to believe today, I didn't talk until I was 3.5 years old. Of course, as a family friend pointed out later, I could never get a word in edgewise anyway. My mom did all the talking for me. She was like my PR agent. Although I was born premature, I think my lack of development was a combination of being extremely shy, something I never really outgrew, and what today might be labeled as a learning disorder. The only thing I had no problems learning was eating. Well, maybe I had one issue I didn't learn, and that was when to stop. Although my siblings and I have the same father, he was really two different guys over the years. My dad drove a bus and was a blue-collar worker. He hustled every day to provide for his family. When I was a young boy, he and a couple of buddies from New York City Transit, as it was then known, opened up a luncheonette in the depot. They made and sold sandwiches in addition to working their regular shifts. My dad was the kind of man who did whatever it took to make sure his family had everything we needed. In a Caribbean family, if you only had two jobs, you were obviously slacking off.
We've just heard Never Going Back by Al Roker. And now, a course of culinary intrigue and the Book Report's introduction to an entertaining author, Cleo Coyle, whose Latte Trouble is book 3 in the Coffee House series. To Claire Cozy's surprise, this fall's hottest fashion trend is anything caffeinated. Designer Lottie Harmon, a loyal Coffee House customer, has created a collection of coffee-inspired fashion accessories. Lottie chooses the Village Blend as the perfect backdrop for Fall Fashion Week and her debut of the new line of Java jewelry. The plot starts to froth when a server unwittingly offers up a poisonous latte. Claire suspects the real target may have been Lottie. Now she must protect her thriving business from negative publicity, Lottie from further danger, and her employee from murder charges. Rebecca Jubel narrates.
Tucker Burton's words were audible over the steam wand's hiss, the buzz of conversation, even the throbbing electronic dance music pulsing out of the Village Blend's speakers. To punctuate his declaration, my best barista butted the bottom of the stainless steel pitcher against the steam wand's spout. The result was a tooth-grinding clang of metal on metal. Then Tucker, who should have known better, pulled the pitcher away too quickly. A geyser of milk froth flowed over the brim, scalding his hand. He cursed, dumped the excess into the sink, and doused his reddening fingers in a rush of cold tap water. It wasn't that I disagreed with Tucker about men. When they acted like pigs, I wanted blood too, so to speak. But Tucker's lethal tone, like the pounding Euro synth pop which was temporarily replacing our typical mix of New Age, jazz, and classical, was disquietingly out of place. Not 5 minutes before, my buoyant barista was pulling espressos and chatting amicably to anyone within earshot. Obviously, someone or something had thrown the nasty switch on the lanky, floppy-haired actor-playwright, who was now slamming around behind the coffeehouse counter like a jealous yenta. And believe me, it takes one to know one. 20 years ago, I'd been a naive bride destined to discover that my handsome husband's extramarital romps were as commonplace as his rock climbing, mountain biking, and cliff diving expeditions during his buying trips to third world coffee plantations. Mateo's defense, that his sexcapades were no more meaningful than any other extreme sport, was supposed to have assured me of his emotional fidelity. I'd responded by pouring a latte over his head. At least I think it had been a latte. It may have been a cappuccino. In any event, I vividly remember white foam dripping down his bewildered features. So froth most definitely had been involved. Behind the low-slung silver espresso machine, out of which a properly trained barista can pull 240 aromatic shots of ebony an hour, Tucker's platonic gal pal, Moira McNeely, paused to reassure him with a friendly touch to his shoulder. A young Bostonian now studying at the Parsons School of Design, she'd taken an interest in the art of coffee preparation, and, I suspected, my thespian cum barista, and had volunteered her services for this fall fashion week after-dinner coffee and dessert soiree, now well underway. And I was thankful, because at the moment, the blend was severely understaffed.
That was Latte Trouble by Cleo Coyle. Best known as the host of Fox's Hell's Kitchen and Kitchen Nightmares, Gordon Ramsay is one of the most driven, successful, and irate chefs around. He has thrown Hollywood actresses out of his restaurants, and shall we say, he's got anger management issues. But he is one of only three chefs in England whose restaurant has a 3-star Michelin rating. In Neil Simpson's Gordon Ramsay on Top of the World, Ramsay discusses the violent, alcoholic, absent father, his best friend and protege's bizarre suicide, the decade-long battle to save his younger brother from heroin and crime, and the real reason he has not attended the births of any of his 4 children. Sometimes hilarious and frequently heartbreaking, this is Gordon Ramsay's life. From tenements and poverty to top-notch restaurants and fame. Richard Aspel narrates.
"Oh my God, what happened to your face?" screeched the room service waitress the moment she clapped eyes on him. Gordon jokes that she almost dropped the food tray in shock. "What do you mean?" he had asked her. It turned out that she had never seen someone in LA with such deep wrinkles on their brow. In her mind, the only possible explanation was that Gordon had just been thrown face-first through a car windscreen. Back then, Gordon had enjoyed laughing off the comment. 1 year later, when his still-wrinkled face was famous and his restaurant was open, he was ready to tough out the food critics as well. He knew his food was far from half-hearted or overcooked. He certainly hadn't dumbed down his menu for the famously shallow residents of La La Land. Over in the stunningly beautiful West Hollywood dining room, his customers could start with slow-braised octopus fingerlings, potato foam, and olive toast. They could have poached rabbit loin, confit beet salad, anchovies, and caper vinaigrette, alongside a broiled black cod, pig's tails with kumamoto oysters, and celeriac puree. If they had room for dessert, they could try chilled coconut tapioca with passion fruit, candied ginger and milk chocolate, star anise sorbet. It was bold stuff. And whatever the critic said, it did the trick. Shortly after opening, the new restaurant was taking 600 calls a day from people desperate for reservations. It was serving nearly 150 guests a night. Forget everyone who wanted Gordon to fail. He had finally cracked America, just as he had cracked pretty much everywhere else. His American dream had begun nearly 2 years earlier in New York. Opening Gordon Ramsay at the London Hotel in that city had been tough, emotionally, physically, and professionally. It had taken a delayed opening, many bad reviews, and one replaced head chef to get things right. But when all this had been done, Gordon felt he had succeeded. He got proof within the year when he was awarded not one, but 2 Michelin stars. So, did he rest on his laurels and take a well-earned break? Does that sound like Gordon Ramsay? No. Having taken Manhattan, squeezed in a new restaurant in Prague, and finished the plans for another in Heathrow's new Terminal 5, he was ready to take on Paris. Gordon hit that most snooty and food-obsessed of cities in typically fiery style. "He's a rat evolving in a festering pot of manure. I jump on his head and kill him," is what reporter John Arledge remembers Gordon screaming out in the week the chef opened Le Trianon in France. For good measure, Gordon was apparently stamping his feet repeatedly, as if killing vermin when he shouted out the words. The target of all this anger was a celebrated French food critic who had given the new restaurant nul point even before it had opened. François Simon had instead done a mini tour of Gordon's London restaurants. He hadn't been particularly impressed. "Going to a Ramsay restaurant," he said, "was like going to the dentist and finding that the dentist's secretary is pulling out your teeth." Gordon was furious. "I've been caned and I haven't even opened yet. How is that possible?" he asked when he first heard that Simon had given him a bad review. But as the word sunk in, he accepted that he could hardly have expected anything less from the French establishment. Taking haute cuisine to France was never going to be easy, especially when your new restaurant is in Versailles, the most glittering real estate prize in Paris. So, what did Gordon do to beat back against those critics? He did what he always did when the heat was on. He got back in the kitchen. He cooked up a storm. He checked up on every last detail of the menu, the service, and the complete dining experience in that most stunning of Parisian settings.
We've just heard Gordon Ramsay on Top of the World by Neil Simpson. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Letters to a Young Chef by Danielle Belloud is written for the professional chef and the amateur cook. It's an invitation into the kitchen from a revered chef who combines traditional technique and modern sensibility. From the reinvention of French food through the fine dining revolution in America, Danielle has been witness to and creator of our contemporary food culture. He's a modern man with a classical foundation, and he speaks with the authority that comes from a lifetime of experience. Part memoir, part advice book, part recipe book, this is a delicious celebration of the art of cooking. Mario Brassard narrates.
Do you really want to be a chef? Writing these letters to you has inevitably made me think of myself when I started out in this business more than 30 years ago. I had yet to see an avocado, taste a truffle, or eat my first dollop of caviar, which happened to be a spoonful of beluga over a turbo braised in champagne sauce. You, on the other hand, having spent 3 years in cooking school, know a lot more about our craft than I did when I threw myself into this career when I was 14. I left our family farm in Saint-Pierre-de-Chandieu and went to work at Restaurant Nandron in Lyon. I very soon got my first taste of truffle. Chef Nandron had just shot a pheasant, grown autumn plump on overripe grapes and juniper berries. He marinated it in cognac and Madeira, stuffed it with foie gras and the first black truffles of the season, then roasted it in juniper butter, with cabbage, salsify root, and a chunk of country bacon. Even for a kid raised on the glorious food of the Rhône Valley, this was a sensual revelation. I knew how to hunt and cook a pheasant country style, but that was simple home cooking, and this was real cuisine. Restaurant Nandron was only 10 miles down the road from home, but my little village remained much as it had been in the 19th century, with the exception of cars and electricity. Lyon, on the other hand, was very much part of the modern world, huge, busy, full of cosmopolitan people with sophisticated tastes. It was a far cry from the Boulou farm, where finding a snake in the barn provided enough excitement for a week's worth of conversation. I loved restaurant work from the moment I tied on a crisp blue apron. Only the chefs wore white. It didn't take me long to decide three things. I knew I loved to cook, I knew that I wanted to learn from the masters, and I knew that being a chef was the only thing I wanted to be. It was probably a stroke of luck that I did not know much more. In the beginning, I didn't have a clue how much it would take to go from a lowly worker in a French restaurant to creating a restaurant of my own in New York City.
We have just heard Letters to a Young Chef by Daniel Boulud. The Book Report is happy to mix it up whenever possible. So here's our first interview with a modern mixologist. Tony Abuganin has just written Vodka Distilled, The Modern Mixologist on Vodka and Vodka Cocktails. The book, written with Mary Elizabeth Faulkner, sets out to help us get a better sense of vodka's proper place in the contemporary cocktail scene. Tony has built a reputation as one of the world's preeminent cocktail experts. He's worked with Mario Batali, Steve Wynn, and many others. He's mixed drinks on the Today Show, Good Morning America, and more. And he's been featured in Time and Vanity Fair. His first book, The Modern Mixologist, is incredibly popular. GQ described it as a modern classic from an industry legend. Welcome, Tony. So great to have you as a guest on The Book Report.
Elaine, so nice to be on the show. Thanks.
All right. How did you get into this business? How did you become the modern mixologist?
Well, Elaine, I grew up in the bar business. My cousin Helen David opened the Brassville Bar in Port Huron, Michigan in 1937, along with her mother, and ran it for nearly 70 years. So in 1980, at the tender age of 20, she agreed to teach me to become a bartender. And I've been doing it ever since.
All right. So what was your inspiration for choosing vodka as your subject matter now?
Well, my first book, The Modern Mixologist, Contemporary Classic Cocktails, touched briefly on every spirit category. And along with my publisher, Agat, we decided that we would do a series of companion books to The Modern Mixologist featuring each individual spirit category. And with vodka being the number one consumed spirit in the United States, we thought the obvious choice would be to go with vodka. But I also think that there's a real misunderstanding with regard to vodka as a category. And with better knowledge becomes better enjoyment. And I think that the better we can educate people on vodka, on the pleasures of vodka, and I'm only talking about straight vodkas, Elaine. I don't touch on any of the flavors. There's no marshmallow vodka in the book. But just enjoying and appreciating the nuances of vodka.
I loved how you shared so much history about vodka. Can you tell us a fact or two?
That's one of the interesting thing about spirits and cocktails in general, is that they do have these great histories and anecdotes and stories that are deep-seated. And for years, I stood in front of the bar not knowing anything about any of the bottles that were behind me. And as I started to delve into the world of mixology and bartending and spirits, it's amazing to discover the histories behind them. And, vodka is one of the oldest spirits that we have. It dates back hundreds of years. There's a great debate whether it was first invented in Russia or Poland. Our research points to Russia as being the birthplace. But that whole Eastern European block, known as the vodka belt, where vodka is drank for vodka's sake, that vodka is consumed on its own, neat from the freezer in a frosty little glass and often served alongside food, is a culture that we really haven't embraced in the United States. So I wanted to bring light to this and share it with my readers and really encourage them to get out there and drink and enjoy vodka and pair it with caviar or foie gras or even something as simple as sliced meats goes beautifully with a chilled frozen glass of vodka.
All right, you touched on something I want to ask you. Should we all keep vodka in the freezer and why?
Well, I believe that for drinking vodka on its own, it's best enjoyed straight from the freezer. When it gets down below zero, the consistency of the vodka changes, the viscosity changes, it takes on this almost syrupy consistency that is just so delightful and so lovely when you first sip it. What happens is you enjoy it, and I'm not one to boast doing shots of frozen vodka like the Russians do. I like to sip it and really kind of enjoy the journey, if you will, how the vodka starts to express itself as it gradually warms up in the glass, as the viscosity changes, a lot of those subtle nuances of the raw materials start to expose themselves. And it really, to me, is a pleasure to just kind of sip that frozen vodka and enjoy it as it warms. Now, I'm hesitant to say that that's the best place to keep it for cocktails, especially cocktails that require a certain amount of dilution, like the vodka martini. In this case, you want a certain amount of dilution from the ice, so I feel it's better to keep it at room temperature. And a final note on tasting. When I do a professional evaluation of vodkas, I always taste them at room temperature, because at room temperature, they really expose all of those subtle nuances.
Now, in the book, you profile 60 vodkas from around the world, and you assign them character scores. Tell us about that.
Well, it's actually 58, to be honest to my your listeners and my readers. It's 58 vodkas from around the world, and I break them down into raw materials. So is it a vodka made from corn or from wheat or from a mix of grains, potato, grape, so that you'll realize that what you're looking for in the vodka, I think, is the characteristics of the raw materials. Now, when we talk about Eastern Europe and the vodka belt, that vodka drinking part of the world, vodkas traditionally had much more character. They were robust. They were sometimes aggressive. They were big bodied. And this is what I would refer to as a vodka with big character, or to steal some verbiage from the wine guys, old world in style, where, you know, the vodka really tastes like vodka. As vodka started to work its way into the West last century, vodkas became much more approachable. By the simple definition of the U.S. government, a vodka is defined as a tasteless, colorless, odorless spirit. So a more feminine style vodka evolved, something that was much lighter in character, what I refer to in the book as New World in style. So not one is better than the other. They're just different. And ultimately, Elaine, it's only your preference. The person with the glass of vodka in front of them, the person drinking and enjoying that glass of vodka, that really can decide which style is their best or their favorite. But just to know that there are these subtle differences, and when I refer to a character like a 7 or an 8, that's a real big, robust, full-bodied vodka, whereas a vodka down in the 3 and 4 range is a softer, more approachable, more neutral in style. Not better, not worse, but different.
Can you share a favorite vodka recipe?
Well, absolutely. I spent 3 years traveling the world with Dale DeGroff, one of my mentors, on behalf of Finlandia Vodka, doing something called Finishing School, and we visited 42 markets. And one of the drinks that Dale would always demonstrate was a drink called the Flame of Love Martini. And the Flame of Love is a drink that came from Chasen's in Los Angeles, and it was created by a bartender by the name of Pepe Ruiz. And Pepe was asked by Dean Martin one evening, he said, "Pepe, I come in here all the time, and I don't have a drink that is created in my honor." And Pepe said, "Mr. Martin, next time you come in, you'll have that drink." And it was the Flame of Love Martini. What it is you take a cold martini glass and you rinse it with Fino sherry, the lightest of all sherries, kind of nutty. And then you stir your favorite, well, Pepe would shake it, but Dale would stir it, favorite vodka, pour that in, flame an orange peel over the top so the oils float beautifully on top, drop in the peel, and hence the Flame of Love Martini. And why I love that cocktail so much is you really get to enjoy the characteristics of the vodka. So often, Elaine, when you make a vodka-based drink, and what drove vodka's popularity in the United States was its mixability. You could virtually mix it with anything, and it would provide the presence of alcohol, the support of the other ingredients. In the case of drinks like the Flame of Love, a drink I created called The Wizard, which is an original Tony Evuganum drink in the new book, Vodka Distilled, you can really taste and appreciate and recognize the subtleties of the specific vodka.
What are you going to be speaking about at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival?
Well, I'm so excited about South Beach Food and Wine Festival. I've been to virtually every one. Lee Schrager, the wonderful Lee Schrager, invited me to the second South Beach Food and Wine Festival when it was just one speaker tent on the beach, and I was the last seminar, and I did a cocktail seminar, and it was standing room only, and I've been back to virtually everyone since. And he's got me doing two seminars, but I'm also launching the book at South Beach.
All right. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, as is your book, which is fun and informative. I really loved it. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tony.
Elaine, it's a pleasure, and I hope I see you at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival.
All right. Bye. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. In 2003, Kathleen Flynn, a 36-year-old American living and working in London, returned from vacation to find her corporate job had been eliminated. Without missing a beat, Flynn cleared out her savings and moved to Paris to pursue a dream, a diploma from the famed Le Cordon Bleu. The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry is Flynn's entertaining and touching account of her transformation as she moves through the school's intense program and falls in love along the way. She weaves recipes with a unique look inside Le Cordon Bleu, its battles with demanding chefs, competitive classmates, and her wretchedly inadequate French. She also cooks up a vibrant portrait of Paris, one where the sights and sounds of the city's markets and purveyors come alive in rich detail. Cassandra Campbell narrates this seductive tale of romance, Paris, and French food.
Today, the chef is not in a good humor. His mercurial moods have earned him a nickname from me, the Gray Chef, not only for his graying hair, but also for the clouds that sometimes follow him into the kitchen. I take care as I arrange and finish my dish and present my plate to the chef for my daily grade. He does not smile as I put it down in front of him. Chef takes a quick taste with a spoon, and his dour face darkens. Suddenly, a wrath is unleashed. My offense, ostensibly minor, a too sweet sauce. But to the Gray Chef, this symbolizes a shameful culinary trespass. He believes I have not followed his mantra to taste, taste, taste while cooking. C'est horrible, he shouts at me. With that, he begins a rant. Ce n'est pas difficile. Pourquoi présenterez-vous ce plat? Vous ne pourriez pas servir ceci. I snatch at words, trying to comprehend. You serve no and this. He slams a meaty fist against the counter, inadvertently tipping the edge of the plate I'd just presented. It spins hard on the marble work table. The tense kitchen halts as the students freeze mid-motion. Chef's face grows visibly red as he escalates his fierce attack on me in rapid-fire French. My head sinks as his voice rises, and I try to fight back the tears, not just from his diatribe, but from the humiliation of being unable to defend myself. In the 9 weeks since classes began, my college French has proved wretchedly inadequate. Everyone waits. The chef stares at me. They expect me to say something, anything in French to my defense. But I can't think of a single word. He sighs. Like most chefs at the school, he speaks little English. Disappointed that I haven't grasped his insulting wrath en français, he waves me away and turns to the next student, a Taiwanese girl with thick glasses. As she apprehensively extends her plate, he volleys over one last assault, the coup de grâce. Vous perdez votre temps. My mind races to translate. Perdez, to misplace? To be lost? To waste. I move to the other words. You, time, your. Then comes the dawn. You're wasting your time. That's it. I turn back to my oven. As the kitchen resumes its buzz, I start to cry. Robotically, I rush to pack up my knives and flee down the three flights of stairs to the cramped basement locker rooms, where I escape into a pocket-sized staff bathroom and lock the door. I cannot stop the tears now. I have not sobbed like this in years. Then I catch my reflection in the mirror. Under a buzzing fluorescent light, I see my smeared mascara and stained kitchen whites. I am 36, unemployed, and I've spent the last of my savings to pursue a dream of studying at Le Cordon Bleu, only to be reduced to tears by a chef I hardly know in a language I barely understand. What am I doing here? Maybe this is all a big mistake. Part 1. Basic Cuisine. This isn't cooking. It's like learning a complicated sport. Kim, a student in basic cuisine. Chapter 1. Life is not a dress rehearsal. I didn't start cooking until I was 32. Until then, I just ate. Julia Child. After a few moments of small talk and tea, my boss leaned over, clasped her hands, and dropped her smile. This is going to be a very difficult conversation, she began. I should have known. It's never a good sign when the boss tells you to avoid the office when you come back from vacation. Worse, she insisted we meet in a hotel lobby 2 hours after my plane had landed. I nodded, kept my composure, and declined an offer of more tea.
That was The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry by Kathleen Flynn. Garlic and Sapphires, The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise, is Ruth Reichel's riotous account of her experiences dining anonymously. As the New York Times food critic, Reichel often went undercover. What is so remarkable about her spy games is that, as she took on various disguises, she finds herself changed, not just superficially, but in character as well. She gives a remarkable account of how one's outer appearance impacts one's inner character. As she writes, every restaurant is theater. Garlic and Sapphires, narrated by the wonderful Bernadette Dunn, is a brilliantly entertaining reflection on the decadent Epicurean theaters of the restaurant world.
It's 3 months till I even start the job. I'm truly stunned. I know, she says, wagging one of those purple fingers in my face. But if your first review's in September, you've got to be eating somewhere now, don't you? There's a certain triumph in her voice as she adds, you see, there's not much we don't know about you. What do you know? This comes out a little more nervously than I'd like. Oh, she says breezily, ask me anything. You'll see. Am I married? Please, she scoffs, ask me something harder than that. Your husband's name is Michael Singer. He's a producer at CBS, and he does mostly investigative work. I know he won a Peabody Award last year for something he did on the mafia and the recording industry. How could you know that? I ask. I told you, she says. We've been studying you. We all have. Didn't I say we were on the lookout for you? No critic eats alone, so that means watching for him, too. Not to mention your kid. He's about four. Four and a half, I say. The response so automatic that it is out before I realize that I ought to be feeding her misinformation, not filling her in. At least I know you're alone on this trip, she says a little too smugly. That's useful. They could be joining me later, I point out. They could, she says, considering. Then she cocks her head to one side and says, Nah, I'd guess not. Guys don't have any patience, and in my experience, it's always the woman who has to travel with the children. If Michael were coming, you'd have the kid. What are you? I ask. Mickey Spillane? In this business, she confides, it pays to keep your eyes open. You'd be surprised how much you can figure out about people after they've been sitting at your table for a couple of hours. Makes the job more fun. This is how I figure it. You're on your way to New York to do a little restaurant research, and maybe look for an apartment. Her eyes meet mine as she says this, and they light up. Gotcha, she says. You are. I'm also looking for a nursery school for Nick, but I manage not to blurt this out. When I don't reply, my new friend examines my tray to see if it contains anything else she might desire. She seems to be waging an inner skirmish over the ice cream bar that now sits there, forlorn and alone. But she abandons the struggle to say smugly, Well, don't think one of those big hats is going to protect you. She studies my face, as if memorizing it, her eyes slowly moving from the long, tangled brown curls past my thick, bushy eyebrows and slightly tilted brown eyes to take in my pale skin and large mouth. At last, she produces a bumptious New York smile and adds, You're going to find that being our critic is very different from being the restaurant critic of the L.A. Times. We're not so easy to fool. I can see that, I say sincerely. In the 15 years I've been a restaurant critic in San Francisco and Los Angeles, nobody has ever bothered to study me before. This woman knows a scary lot about me. I wouldn't be surprised if she knows that the New York Times is going to pay me $82,000 a year, a cut from what I've been making in Los Angeles, or even that CBS has been very good about letting Michael move to the New York Bureau. Knowing that my personal life is now public makes me so nervous that I try to change the subject. Please, I say, holding out my ice cream, take this. I need to save my appetite for dinner. She accepts. No wonder you're so thin, she says, peeling off the paper wrapper. She looks at the ice cream before taking a bite. Mouth full, she adds, This isn't bad, but I'd much rather have the name of the restaurant you're going to tonight. It's worth a lot of money, and I could certainly use it. Not a chance, I reply, and turn to stare at the clouds floating outside the window like great billows of marshmallow fluff. You finished everything, says the flight attendant when she picks up the trays. She seems genuinely surprised. I smile up at her. This was an educational lunch. Oh, she says, looking slightly bewildered. I'm glad. Piling the trays onto her cart, she adds, People don't usually say that. Then she pushes off quickly, as if she's afraid that I will attempt to engage in further discussion of the food. But food is the farthest thing from my mind. I'm considering my next plan of action. One of the primary requisites of a good restaurant critic is the ability to be anonymous. Clearly, I'm going to have to do something. But what? Flying east, it takes 4.5 hours to go from LAX to JFK. It is just long enough. By the time we land, I have figured the whole thing out. Backstory. This is Warren Hoag, announced a self-satisfied voice when I picked up the phone. Assistant Managing Editor of the New York Times. He proclaimed it proudly, as if faint trumpets were sounding off in the background. Yes, I said, hoping my tone conveyed more interest than I was actually feeling. It was 2 months before that fateful trip to New York, and I was staring across the sad, low landscape of downtown Los Angeles, wondering how to make Easter more exciting.
We've just sampled Garlic and Sapphires by Ruth Reichel. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed today's Literary Fest. For more books to sate your hunger, whatever your favorite genre, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope to see you back here next week on The Book Report.